Thank you very much, Mr. Moore. Greetings to all of you, and greetings to all of those listening in on the phone line or the internet. Let's go to Revelation 3 today. I want to begin the sermon there. Did you hear about the man who was looking for a job? He was filling out the application, and he got to this one particular line, and they asked him in the application, "What do you think is your best attribute?" And he wrote in that column, "I was fired 16 times. Well, the manager of the store he was applying at came up to him and said, how could this be your best attribute? And he says, "Well, it shows I'm no quitter." On another level, altogether different, I don't think I've hardly ever watched the Oscars. But this year I read the reviews, and they were pretty bad about America's representation around the world, the Oscars themselves. But they had one thing that I thought was really right on, and that is that they nominated the picture, The King's Speech, for Best Picture. And I had a chance to see that movie recently, and I thought it was a movie of epic proportions with a message that is, I think, really helpful for all of us. You know, it had some bad language in it. However, there is, again, this story that I'm sure you can see relates to us. It may sting a little bit, but it really stings in a way that's good for us. And so anyway, the story is about King George VI of England. And he was the second son of King George V. And because he was a second son, he didn't think they would ever have a chance at having a shot at the throne of England. And as a second son, and knowing that he wasn't designated to become king after his father's death, his father often ridiculed him and his brother humiliated him. And as a result, he developed this very severe speech defect. And because of the constant ridicule and humiliation he went through. And he never expected that this would ever matter because he was never going to be able to be the king, because certainly his brother, Edward, was destined to ascend to the throne. So when his father died, Edward did take control of the throne. However, prior to that happening, he had met Mrs. Wallace Simpson. And although she was already married, he began an affair with her while she was married. He fell head over heels in love with her, and she divorced her husband, and he planned to marry her. You know, it was also known throughout England that Mrs. Simpson had other lovers at the same time. Besides that, she had contacts with higher-ups within the Nazi Party. And so the church and the government absolutely could not accept him marrying her. And so he felt, only one choice he could make, and that was to abdicate the throne. And so Edward abdicated his position as king of England in order to marry this woman. And to me, there is a story in this of enormous consequence for you and me today. You know, in a lot of circles, this is actually thought of as a wonderful love story, because here was a man who was willing to give up everything he had, his name, his reputation, his wealth, his status, everything, for the love of his life. And so a lot of people look at it that way, that he gave up everything for her. And a lot of people admire this decision, and there is a romantic side, it seems, to it, and people think this is really something wonderful. But I say this, what happened was his brother had to take the throne. And when his brother took the throne, he didn't want it. And the reason was he had this horrible speech impediment. And the whole movie is about his hard work to overcome that speech impediment, because England needed him to do it. And he had so much courage to face his handicap and to plow through this. That's one story. But there's another story, and that's the story of Edward and what happened to him. You know, he had the royal crown within his grasp, and he let that crown go to somebody else. And England was being drawn into war at the time, and he abandoned the crown. And here's what he said. He made this historic statement: "I, Edward VIII, of Great Britain, Ireland, and the British Dominions beyond the seas, King, Emperor of India, do hereby declare my irrevocable determination to renounce the throne for myself and for my dependents, and my desire that effect should be given to this instrument of abdication immediately." And he disowned his title. He disowned his position, and he disinherited his descendants and his nation. His brother was kind to him. He gave the couple, when he remarried this lady, when her divorce was final, the Duke of Windsor and the Duchess of Windsor, but they were exiled to France, and that's where they spent the rest of their life. Many people thought it would just last a few years, but it ended up being their entire lifetime. Edward finally died, and his wife spent 14 years more in seclusion. And it was a terrible, I think, lonely life for them in that sense. Anyway, now his brother becomes the king and reluctantly accepts the responsibility and works extremely hard. And Lionel, an assistant, helped him to overcome his handicap. And he gave a number of very good speeches to encourage the British people through the war that they had to go through. But he put out enormous effort to do so. His brother Edward, who abdicated, did something that monarchs don't have the luxury to do. He abandoned his responsibility towards everybody else in that nation. He abandoned his loyalty to the country, and he gave up his crown, and that's something that no other British official has ever done in the history of England. Now, for this, I think, to happen has a vivid, if you can see it, application for you and for me today, because you and I are called to be kings one day and to rule under the King of Kings. However, you know and I know that not everybody is going to accept that. There are going to be people who, because of the pleasures of this life, are going to renounce their opportunity to have that crown and to rule with Jesus Christ. They're not going to be willing to make the sacrifices that are going to be necessary to do it. And I say that there is tremendous honor in what we're called to. I say there's tremendous honor in what King George VI did, and tremendous dishonor to what his brother Edward did, that he let a country down and a people down by abdication. And we must not ever let that. Before anything like this ever happens to any of us, I ask us today to please ask this question of ourselves. Ask this one: are you willing to give up the throne? Is there anything that could take that throne away from you? Would you let go of it for any reason at all? I want you to listen to God's counsel to us at the end of the age. In Revelation 3 and verse 11, he says this: "Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast that which you have, that no man take your crown." He wants us to hold on to our crown that is coming. 2 Timothy 4. Sometimes people think that this is talking about somebody else being awarded your crown. And that is a possibility. If we lose our crown, there is always someone in line, isn't there, to take it. there's someone else, because many are called, but few are chosen. And so my point is that there will always be someone right behind us that will be willing and happy to take our crown, somebody doing all that they can. The word here for man, let no man take your crown, is medais in the Greek, and it means man or woman, but you know what else? It means something. In other words, don't let something, some lust, some desire, some pleasure take your crown. You know, it's really saying that anything can cause you to lose it. Down through history, this has happened to a number of people. 2 Timothy 4 and verse 10 says something really interesting. Paul writes, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. Well, that's what's happening in the reading, and we're listening to what's happening to Judah and Jerusalem and the people there. They had something they wanted more than God, and look at the suffering they went through as a result. And I say this is one of the biggest dangers to the people of God during this end time age. We are becoming content as a people, and we're becoming involved in trying to accumulate more materialism that is a part of this world. And in doing so, many of the people of God around the world are forgetting God, and they're putting other things in His place. We're forgetting that we were called to wage a war on sin. That's how we started, wasn't it? With that in mind, called to wage war on sin, and we're getting a sense of confidence in who we are and what we know about the Bible, and we're letting down spiritually, and that's the problem. We could lose our crown. So he spoke of this time that we live in now, just a little earlier in 2 Timothy 4, this time in verse 3. Where he says, the time's going to come when they won't endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they shall be turned away their ears from the truth and be turned unto fables. Man, do you think we're not being turned unto fables today? We're being taught that we don't have to eat unleavened bread on all 7 days of unleavened bread. We're being taught that we can work a few minutes on the Sabbath and it's really going to be okay. We're being taught that it's all right to do business on the Sabbath. We're being taught that the form of government is the reason for the problems in the church, when the real reason is what? Our human nature and ourselves is the real reason for the problems. We're being taught that we've got to have the right calendar. We've got to say God's name the right way or else we're not going to make it. We're being taught that our group is superior to other groups, that we're the good guys, and if you're a part of this group, you'll have salvation and you won't have to go through the tribulation. That's fables. It's all fables. That's what it is. And that's what's being taught today. It's all ludicrous to me. James 1, James, Peter, and John. It's all ludicrous to me that these things that are going around and seeming to take hold of people and drive them in their beliefs. God tells us to hold fast to what we have, and He's not referring to some teachings that we received earlier from some man. That's not what he's referring to us holding fast to, which some believe and teach today, and that's another fable. But he's referring to this, our belief that we're to trust no man, not even ourselves, but only trust what God tells us in His Word. That's the only thing we can depend on for sure. Do you remember how "don't trust me, but trust your Bible" was hammered out over and over again by Mr. Armstrong? Don't trust me, but trust your Bible is what he said. And that time, that's what we believed. That's what we taught. That's what we lived by. We were called to a holy war, jihad, if you want to use that term, against sin. We were to combat our human nature, and we knew it. We were to resist the pulls of the devil and the kind of sparkle that the world has and the attraction it has for us, like a crow, like something sparkling. And they have lots of glitter, and they've got lots of things going on in the media, and they've got a lot of things that are attractive. James puts it the following way in verse 12 of chapter 1. Blessed is that man that endures temptation. For when he's tried, he shall receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to them that love him. And that's what we seek. We seek a crown that's going to include having eternal life. And we've got to resist temptation. As one email that was sent to me said, regarding chocolate, resistance is futile. But that's how some people feel about different things in life. And I'm teasing about the chocolate, but you understand, to some people, we all have a sin that so easily besets us. We all have something that is something we want, and if we're lusting for it, if we're wanting that more than we want the kingdom of God, then we are making that fatal mistake, and we could lose our crown over it, and that's my point today. So we've got something we all have to fight. 2 Timothy again in 4. 2 Timothy in chapter 4 again. This time in 7 and 8. Paul said this. He's such a great example in so many ways. All that he went through and, you know, fighting with beasts and shipwrecks and everything that he went through, beatings and stonings. And he said, I've fought a good fight. I've finished my course. I have kept the faith. Boy, it would be wonderful to be able to say that. And he says then, henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day. And not to me only, but unto all of them that love his appearing. Well, if that's what we're looking forward to, if that's what is on our mind, if that's our hope, his coming and his appearing, then we are going to be filled with joy and we'll be one of those. And we'll receive that crown that we are headed for and that we're called to. And we'll be able to rule with Jesus Christ. I can hardly wait for that. Because of this, in 2 Corinthians, let's move over there, he speaks again of this crown. And he refers to the garland that's worn, 2 Corinthians 9. The garland that's worn by the winner of what was then the Greek athletic games that has now morphed into the Olympics. And it was worn by them. And so he uses it in this context, and he writes in verse 24. I'm sorry, 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 24. Know you not that they which run in a race run all, but only one receives the prize? So run, he says, so that you may obtain. And every man that strives for the mastery, he says, is temperate in all things. And they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. And so I therefore run not so uncertainly, and I fight not as one that beats the air, but I keep my body and bring it into subjection, lest at any means when I preach to others, I should be a castaway. And so this is my point today. You know, we are in a race, running in this race, and that's my point. We may have things that we desire in this life, but everything in this life is physical, and it's just temporary. It all decays. It rusts. I mean, you talked about the tsunami that happened today, and you saw what happened. Buildings, entire buildings, cars, boats, planes were all just being pushed in as garbage with flames coming out of it. It doesn't last. Everything here is temporary, and God himself says this. If you love the world, those things are enmity against God. He's not about these physical things. He's about a glory and a majesty far beyond what we can understand completely. But we're going for a crown that is incorruptible, something that's going to last forever and never, ever lose its luster, never lose its shine, and never lose its meaning. And I say it has meaning beyond our wildest imagination. We're not talking about a crown of status or a crown of glory for ourselves, you understand? This is not a crown that is one born out of ambition. This is not about just being over other people and in charge of cities. It's not about that. I remember another group I was in, it was years ago, And I remember that we were all talking, and somebody explained that one of the men that was with us had left and gone to another organization. And I remember the number two man in that organization said this. He said, "Oh, well, another jewel in my crown." You understand what's wrong with this picture? The whole idea is wrong. What's this crown for? It's not about ourselves and our ego. It's not about us becoming more and greater. It's not about that at all. And we're supposed to be fighting human nature. And this was just leading right into it, just being sucked right into it and following it. But we're being offered more than just sitting on a crown and ruling over people. We're going to be able to share in the majesty and the glory of God Almighty Himself. We're going to be able to have holy and righteous character, part of us, an integral part of us, eternal life, an integral part of us. We're going to have the power of God. We're going to have the mind of God, who sent the galaxy spiraling into space and says He knows the name of every star. We're going to have that kind of a mind, and we'll have the power of God to be able to help these people that have suffered for 6,000 years on this earth. That is worth it. That's not the crown of England. That is so valuable. And what we do with that crown is going to last for all eternity as we help bring the rest of the people of God into the family of God. So anyway, that's the goal that we're to be holding fast to. That's what we're supposed to be holding on to. And that is exactly where we are failing as a church today all around the world. We're all being distracted, it seems, in one way or another. You know, some are focusing on other things than God's way. They're focusing on career, and they're focusing on the religious group they're with, and some are focusing on materialism. And you can't convince me that we aren't doing that. And I know in that same other group I was with, you know what the leading guy told me? He said, "I want you to take this guy out to dinner, and I want you to treat him really good because he's a big tithe payer." You think we don't care about materialism in the Church of God? It's a cancer. And as the world gets more and more short on money in our world, it's going to become more and more important to people. We've got to watch that, and don't let it rob us of that crown we're destined for. Take him out and treat him well. Okay. Just like James says, right? Don't do that. You know, the point is I want to make here is that all of us slip, all of us fall, and we all make mistakes. Let's go over to Numbers 11. Numbers, Deuteronomy. Every one of us has various flaws, various histories, various tendencies genetically. All of us slip as a result, and we all fall. And it's even funny in one sense how you see that even there's this litany, actually, of great leaders of God down through the Bible, and all of them had a point at which they were willing to give up their crown. And it just kind of blew me away, and as I read these things, and I realized what was really happening here. But look at this. Moses, great man of God that he was, in Numbers 11 and verse 15. He was so tired of it, he told God this: "If you deal thus with me, kill me, I pray thee, out of your hand. If I found favor in your sight, let me not see my own wretchedness." Kill me. Do it right now. Take me out of the game. Okay, Joshua, great general, handpicked. Handpicked by God, Joshua 7. Here's another man who was to lead Israel into the promised land, and he was a type of Jesus Christ, who I believe is to live in us and cast down, create a holy war within us, you might say, and casting down our idols. This man, Joshua, whose name is Jesus in the New Testament, also was a type of that. And remember how Achan sinned, and he took the gold, and he took the idols, and so on. And as a result, the men of Ai were able to beat the Israelites there. and all the Israelites suffered for this one man's sin. So here we have Joshua 7, verse 5 and 6. And the men of Ai smote them, about 30 and 6 men, for they chased them from before the gate even into Shebarim, and smote them in the going down, wherefore the hearts of the people melted and became like water. And Joshua rent his clothes and fell to the earth upon his face before the ark of the Lord until eventide, he and the elders of Israel, and put dust on their heads. Notice the response of Joshua. And you wonder, well, where's his dedication? Where's the fight left in him? You know, something's wrong, yes, but you don't want to give up. But look what he says at this point in verse 7. Joshua said, "Alas, O Lord God, wherefore have you at all brought this people over Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites and destroy us? Would to God we had been content and dwell on the other side of the Jordan. Let's not even go into the promised land," see? Here he is at a point because things didn't go the way he thought, because he was losing. He wants to give up the throne or the crown that he could be called to have. And so my point is that this happens to all of the great men and women of God. And again, let's go to 1 Kings and look at the case of Elijah. Elijah is one of the great prophets. Let's go to chapter 19. One of the greatest prophets in the Bible, I think, and certainly one of the most respected. And he's challenging the idolatry of his day, and he calls down fire, you know, and burns up the sacrifice in front of everybody miraculously. And then he kills all of the priests of Baal there, and he has this powerful victory. And then, of course, Jezebel sets out to kill him, and he runs from her. And she's going to seek his life. And he's right there. He stumbles. He falls. He's actually willing to give up right at this point. 1 Kings 19 and verse 4. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die. And he said, "It's enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I'm not better than my father's." And so he wanted to give up. I remember reading a case once where Mr. Armstrong said the same thing. I mean, just everything was going wrong. There was a massive rebellion within the church. And he said, you know, "I just prayed and said, God, couldn't I just die now?" You know, because sometimes you get tired, I guess. And, you know, these people stumbled and I've stumbled. And I think all of us at one time or another have. Job put it really beautifully, though. He's, to me, really put it poetically, if you want to go over there for Job 3. And he also, was a righteous man. And he loved God and he followed God's way. And things went well for him. But all of a sudden they turned the other way. And they suddenly went wrong for him. And then his attitude went into the ditch. You know, they turned for the worse. And he wanted to give up his race. But he says it so eloquently. He just wanted to quit. Job 3. And verse 1, "And this opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. And Job spoke, and he said, 'Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which was said, there's a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months." Just eliminate that day from the calendar that I was born, you know. "Lo, let the night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. Let them curse it that curse the day, who are ready to raise up their mourning. Let the stars of the twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrows from my eyes." Couldn't we just close those doors of my mother's womb, okay, so I can't get out and I just stay there? This guy's eloquent, isn't he? "Why died I not in the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did I have to go through all of this?" See, Job had it tough. There's no question. I mean, he must have been a pretty tough guy to be able to go through everything that he went through. But he still, like all of us, came to a point where he was thinking, boy, I wish I didn't have to do this. I wish I could quit. I wish it didn't have to happen. I wish it was over. He would give up his crown at that point. It's too tough. It's too tough, he's going. That's what he's saying. You know, Saul is, to me, the quintessential example of losing your crown. All these others that we read about, they all came back. They made the turn. They saw the error of the way, and they came back to God, and they put him first. Saul is another example. First Samuel, if you will, 15. First Samuel 15, where you see the case of Saul, who, as you remember, he had not killed the king, Agag, as he was instructed by God, and he didn't kill the best of the sheep and the animals. He saved those for himself, and he was criticized by God for that. And then he refused to wait for the prophet to give an offering, and he took it within his own hands. And at first, when he was called, he was humble. He wanted the best for Israel, and he wondered, well, why me? You know, who am I? And then later, he thought he could make decisions as ever he wanted, whatever he thought was right. And so he lost that humility, and he began to do these things of his own accord and take things into his own hand. In verse 22 here, it says, "And Samuel said to him, 'Has the Lord a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice?'" He's explaining why he offered the sacrifice. "'As in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice,' he says, 'and to hearken than the fat of rams.'" So there's a lesson for us, isn't it? To obey is the most important thing. "For rebellion," he says, "is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also rejects you from being king." So here we see the similar set of circumstances. If we reject God and holding fast to his word, if we do that, he could reject us from being kings in the kingdom. And that possibility exists. And that's why I'm warning us today about this. I think the movie made a wonderful point. "And Saul said unto Samuel, 'I've sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice.'" Well, as things get tougher and tougher, are we going to fear the people? Are we going to fear them and then sidestep God's law? Or are we going to hold fast to his law no matter what happens? That's the question I have for us today. "Now, therefore," he says, "I pray you, pardon my sin and turn again with me that I may worship the Lord." And Samuel said unto Saul, "I will not return with you, for you've rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel." And then as Samuel turned about to go away, then he laid hold of the skirt of his mantle, and it rent. And Samuel said to him, "The Lord has rent the kingdom of Israel from you this day and given it to a neighbor of yours that is better than you." Another man took his crown. And that's something we don't want to happen to us. A terrible tragedy occurred. But it occurred because he did other than what God commanded and was stripped of his reward. Stripped of his crown publicly in that manner. Must have been terribly, terribly embarrassing. Many are called, but few are chosen. Why is that? The reason is the reason that some of us are like Saul. The ego gets in the way. The self takes center stage. We lose sight. We become distracted and we lose sight of the kingdom and its value to us. We become discouraged sometimes, dissatisfied with things the way they're going. We become depressed in life. It can happen to all of us. And Jesus, when he was going to go through the terrible suffering he was going to go through, became very depressed. And he asked God, "Is there any other way?" And he said, "Whatever your will is, that's what I'm going to do." And something we might have to face. tsunami the way they did in Japan. We may have to face terrible crises, terrible things that may happen in our nation, a dearth, as they are in Jeremiah, suffering a dearth because of disobedience. We may suffer right along with them, just like ancient Israel suffered along with the Egyptians for a number of those first few plagues. We may have to suffer some of that. Well, what's going to happen? You see, this is dangerous for us in our race for the kingdom if we let these things ever affect our commitment to that kingdom. Hard times, I believe, are coming. And whenever you have a race that you're in, as Paul writes, we are in a race. It takes patience, it takes training, and it takes endurance to do it. And it always is difficult. So look, if you're called of God and you're getting tired of the fight, if things are tempting you, and if life's issues are pressing on you, and the responsibilities that you have are beginning to crowd out your spiritual life, I want you to remember this truth. It was Dick Ames who taught fundamentals of theology at Ambassador College, and I was in his class, and I'll never forget, from time to time, he would say this statement, and he would remind us of this, and he would say to us, class, never give up. Never give up. Never, ever give up. And that's what I want us to remember, his words, no matter how tough it gets, don't ever give up. To me, there's a story that I think illustrates this principle fairly well. It was middle school, and it was their track day, and all the kids and the parents were surrounding the, you know, looking in the grandstands. The kids, you can imagine, they were trembling with anxiety and excitement as they were standing on the line ready to go. The gun explodes. The kids bolt from the starting line, and Billy is confident he's one of them. They all intend to win this race, every one of them. Billy is confident, I can do it. As they get to the turn, something happened. Somebody's foot hit his foot. He tripped and fell and rolled into the dirt. And he got up, you know, and he wasn't hurt. And he said, you know what? I think I can still catch these guys. I still have a chance to win this race. He gets back and he starts running. But in this case, his head and his heart are running faster than his feet. And he loses his equilibrium. He falls a second time. And now the words are ringing in his head. Defeat. You know, defeat. Then he looks at the crowd and he sees his father's face. And his father's face is telling him, get back up and get in the race. So he gets back in the race, and he's running with everything he has, and he's pulling somehow from somewhere on strength he didn't even know he had. He catches up to the back of the pack. He's like 10 feet away from the last guy, loses his equilibrium again, and falls, tumbling into the dirt again. Now he's laying there, and a tear comes out of his eye, and he knows, I failed. I'm never going to win. I can never catch up. And it's almost like he could hear his dad's voice in his head. And his dad's voice in his head is telling him, you weren't born for failure like this. Get up and run the race. So he gets back up, and he starts running the race again. And within a few moments, the winner crossed the finish line. And the crowd was laughing when he fell, when the first Billy fell. But now he hears them cheering ahead of him because the guy crossed the finish line. And he's still running. He comes in last, way last. And then he starts to walk to the showers, and he hears something he never thought he'd ever hear. The crowd is cheering way more for him finishing that race than they even cheered for the winner of the race. Later he talked to his dad, and he said, Dad, I really feel bad, like I let you down. You know, I didn't do very well out there, to say the least. And his dad said, to me, you won. You rose every time you got back in the race. Can't you just see our father saying the same thing to us? Yes, you stumbled. Yes, you fell. But you got back up. That's what he cares about. person with heart that's going to finish the race, somebody that won't quit, is so much more valuable than a shooting star that's got great skills from the beginning. Someone who will stick with it, someone that won't quit. And that's what we've got to be. Someone that will hold fast to that crown and will not let go, no matter what happens in our lives, no matter what it looks like on the outside. So Billy didn't care anymore if he won or lost. He was just going to finish, and that's how we've got to be, because our race is not given to just one person. Our race isn't just the guy who crosses the finish line first. Our race is to finish the race that was started. And Christ says he'll be with us, he will not leave us or forsake us. And he says this, that he will finish the work he started in us if we stay with it. And that's what we're called to do. So it's not coming in first that matters. I remember I worked in air conditioning for a number of years, and I remember I made a pretty serious mistake, and I was called into the office one day, and they told me what the problem was. And I apologized to him, but I felt really humiliated and embarrassed, actually. And I felt like I just wanted to quit in the worst way. And I told him, I'm just really sorry. And I remember the general manager of the company said to me, he said, Art, it's not the fact that you're knocked down. It's what you do when you get back up that matters. And those words have rung with me and stayed with me to this day. What great advice. And that's good advice for any Christian running the race, isn't it? It's not the fact that you're knocked down. It's what you do after you get up. Keep going. Don't let go. Keep going in all of these things. And I say this because every one of us at some point is going to make a mistake in our lives, and we're going to get distracted. And I'm suggesting to you that things are going to get worse and worse. We're already seeing earthquakes in different places, tsunamis like in Japan. America's leadership in the world is becoming almost laughable. It's coming to an end. We have become the greatest debtor nation in the world today. We produce most of the world's pornography right here in our country. We abort children now as a way of life, you know. Marijuana stores are popping up all over the place. I heard there's three of them in Billings. And Billings has a population of 100,000 people. You know, how many of them are getting their high, you know? It's just amazing to me. But you understand that sexual sin is becoming rampant. Alcohol abuse is on the rise. Violence is on the increase. And I see from time to time these cars going to homes now, more often police cars going to homes, because I know domestic violence is going on there. But we have primarily become a nation concerned with our possession, and money is what matters. It's leisure, it's entertainment. Those things have become a priority in our lives. Trust in God, it's waning. Belief in the Bible is becoming the butt of jokes on television and movies today. That's what's happening in our nation. We're living at what I believe is the beginning of the end times, because I used to say there's a window yet. Well, that window's now kind of closed, and now we're beginning the end times, and you're starting to see the earth groaning as we see these terrible disasters taking place in our weather across the United States and all other places around the world. You know, no matter what we feel like, because of disasters that may come, troubles that may come, financial difficulties or woes or illnesses, or no matter what we have to suffer, we cannot abandon our crown. Luke 13, if you will. We can't let it go. We'll make it with his help. He promises to be there. He promises to help us make it. And so I want you to consider, before I finish today, I want you to just consider the other side, okay? Giving it up, giving up the crown, going for something else, getting distracted. What's that going to be like? Imagine this scene, verse 24 of chapter 13, verse 24. Jesus says this, strive to enter in at the straight gate. For many, I say unto you, will seek to enter in and won't be able. Many are called, but only a few are chosen. Not everybody's going to make it. Not everybody's going to get that crown. When once the master of the house is risen up and is shut to the door, and you begin to stand outside and to knock on the door saying, Lord, Lord, open to us, and he shall answer and say unto you, I know you not whence you are. Then shall you begin to say, oh, we've eaten and drunk in your presence, and we've taught in your streets. And then I'll tell you, I know you not from whence you are. Depart from me, you workers of iniquity. And then guess what? There's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth when you see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, and yourselves thrust out. Can you see the other side? Can you imagine yourself looking and seeing your friends and your family and brethren and people you've known all your lives in the kingdom with those great heroes of faith and with Jesus Christ having their crowns and you cast out? Can you imagine what that's going to feel like? Can you imagine the embarrassment, the tragic loss? Can you imagine how you could feel? I want you to imagine it because I want us to remember to never let down. I want us to remember this is what it's going to look like if we go some other direction or drop out. I'm convinced that seeing the glory of the kingdom is the reason that these people see weeping and gnashing of teeth. You understand, the Protestant community teaches that they're going to be going to hell and they're going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth because of the punishment God's going to give them. I don't believe that. I believe they're weeping and gnashing their teeth because they see how beautiful the people of God that made it in the resurrection are. They see the enormous sense of joy that they have. They see the beauty of the glory and majesty of these people, and they see their glorious reward that they missed. They could have had, but they missed. And it's just anguish and torment inside internally. And I believe that even if they make it in the second resurrection, even if they make it then, they'll always remember, I had a chance and missed it because they didn't hold on. We've got to finish the race, and we can't be stopped. This is our main purpose in life. We can't become distracted by other things. Philippians, if you'll go to Philippians 3, we can't let the problems, we can't let the pleasures, we can't let the lusts, we can't let any of these things take us away from what our goal is. That goal is so important, and that goal has so many wonderful fruits and is so valuable that we must let nothing stop us, and we've got to see how valuable it is. And remember, as the time draws closer to the end, there's going to be distractions abounding on every side. Don't get caught up in them. Don't fear. Don't worry. Just trust God. No matter what happens, it's going to be all right. Remember this. If a man strives for the masteries, he's not crowned unless he does it lawfully. It's always the answer. It's not all these perverse different doctrines. It's not all these calendar issues. It's not forms of government. It's living lawfully, living the way God intended us to live according to his intent. And that's what we've got to focus on, not the peripheral issues or all distractions. Holding fast to God's law in his intent is the issue. And doing this until it becomes a habit is the issue. And doing it on and on until it becomes a literal part of us is what it's all about, staying in that race. So we are to practice each day, thinking as he thinks, and practice each day, living as he lives. Strive to live as God lives, as Paul says here in Philippians 3 and verse 13. Brethren, I don't count myself to have apprehended. He didn't have it made yet. He knew that. Nobody has it made until we die. But this one thing I do. Forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Jesus Christ. Let us therefore, as many as be perfect, be thus minded. And if anything you're otherwise minded, God will reveal even this unto you. That's what he's doing right now. He's revealing this to you. Stay in the race. We haven't apprehended yet. Stay in the race and reach for that crown. Reach for that goal in everything we do each day.